So one of the features of this kind of forum is that we have it's open conversation after this point. We have about 35 minutes or so for your comments and questions and dialogue. So I'll just turn the floor open to you all. I ask only that you introduce yourself before you make a comment or pose a question. Yeah, welcome.
Hi, my name is Yael Levin. I'm a PhD student in the political science department. I was hoping you could speak more to the after school or out of school activities you would recommend as well. It seems from my reading of the literature, my experience in low income areas, one big problem is trust in communities and a safe place for kids to be out when school ends and their parents are still at work. That could do a lot towards promoting, you know, community cohesion and individuals feeling empowered. Do you have any recommendations on that front?
Yeah, so there are some really wonderful examples of organizations that are doing this work in these communities out of school, both after school and in partnership with schools and also quite separately. So say, giving some examples just from Boston, the Hyde Square Task Force, which is a community organizing and youth organizing group in Jamaica Plain, is a real refuge for kids. They have an academic tutoring component and a dance team and stuff like that, and a youth organizing group. And there is some fluidity between those, so kids may come in because of dance or tutoring and then get pulled into youth organizing. One thing that's notable is that they pay kids to be organizers, and so it's a real demonstration of respect for kids' time, and it's also a sort of it's a route to professionalism for them. But then they create these amazing changes in not only in Jamaica Plain, but in the city as a whole. So one of the things that they advocated for example, was they were learning power analysis and other things. They said, all of our friends should be learning this stuff. It's not just us here at Hyde Square Task Force. And so they organized and won a pilot civics course for the high school in BPS that is now, I think, being taught in 8 high schools across BPS, and they're now working to try to get it to be in all of the BPS high schools. There are a number of university and youth partnerships, especially around, say, YPAR, Youth Political, why am I blanking out? Youth Participatory Action Research. Michelle Fine is a national leader in this regard, where, say, kids and do research about issues that matter in their community, and they become empowered as researchers and become empowered as activists and spokespeople as well to really make change. And so there are great examples of that. There are also really wonderful examples that don't overtly have anything to do with civic engagement, whether it's computer clubs or boys and girls clubs or sports teams or other things, but that are structured in ways that give youth significant voice and give youth the opportunity to exercise leadership and to see themselves as potential contributors and not merely recipients of others' largesse and not merely sort of these bundles of deficits with needs that have to be addressed. Because that's one of the biggest things, is that we so often especially treat young, low-income youth of color as having all these needs and that we're just like pouring resources into them because they need all this stuff. They are really valuable potential contributors as well. They may have needs, you know, we all have needs, and they do too, but they also have things to contribute, and they have virtues. And the more that we can think of out-of-school opportunities as well as in-school opportunities as helping young people to feel themselves able to make a difference and to see themselves making a difference and have others, including adults, see them making a positive difference, that can lead to, I think, a quite virtuous cycle of their feeling more engaged and empowered, and also others being willing to give them more power because they can see that the young people can make a positive difference.
Thank you so much for your presentation. It's really exciting, especially to think about the possibilities that your ideas can have for creating a stronger civic culture in general, and I think that's really the telos that you have here. I'm a minority product of an inner city sort of school who actually...
Tell us your name, too.
Oh, sorry. My name is Nicole Flores, and I'm a PhD student here in the theology department and a graduate research assistant here at the Boise Center. my school just happened to have a magnet school program within it that really promoted civics in terms of service, organization, organizing things, etc. It was really fantastic, and I think really opened the door for me personally and for other people in my community to really get involved with things. But one thing that was really troubling in our particular community was the stigma associated with any sort of organization. It was, of course we thought that other students should get involved and be along there with us, but we paid a social cost in the community for being involved with those things and for promoting them. I just wonder if you have, because it sounds like you have a really rich experience, if you had any experience with that stigma and some potential responses to that in trying to address this gap that I think is a very real thing.
So was the stigma that you were sort of uppity and better than others? Was this
that you were uppity and better, that you were getting involved with the man, that you were becoming white, you were moving away from your roots, that you weren't real, that you didn't have credibility, even just that you were a geek and nobody wanted to interact with you, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, have you faced any of that, and how did you
respond? That's a good question. I actually haven't. But one of the things, so I have done this work with young people always in the context of being a teacher, where therefore everybody had to do it, right? And so in a way, it normalizes it, and you don't end up having kids being the, selective ones who and this is one of the arguments I actually give in favor of doing this work in schools and not just out of school or in partnerships or so forth, because many of the organizations and the people who really care about youth empowerment say schools are disasters. Like, why are you going to try to work there, right? They have these zero tolerance policies, and the teachers are always screaming at the kids, and you have no time, and you have the tests, and, schools. And one of the really strong reasons, I think, to work in and with schools is that you reach all kids. And that one of the things that we know, say again from the political science and political sociology and political psychology literatures, are that in many cases, human beings, whether adults or kids, become motivated and involved not because they think of themselves originally as having a civic or political identity or something that they care about enough to get involved, but because they have done it for whatever reason. A friend has invited them, and so they went. It's what one did at their house. It's an adult mentor said, come with me and do this. I talked to a whole bunch of youth civic leaders, actually, in four different cities when I was doing research for the book. And in almost all, in a number of cases, they had gotten in because of the free pizza, because they were paid, because of something that had nothing to do with civic or political activism. And it's through the act of doing that you then develop the sense of identity. I am a person who does this. This is part of who I am. And you develop the knowledge that gives you the motivation to say, and this is an issue I really care about, and I know something about it, and I can do something about it. That was one thing that was nice about doing this with my kids as a teacher, is they all were forced to do it. Some kids, of course, hated it all the way through, just like some kids hate math all the way through, or baseball, or whatever. But then there were kids who really unexpectedly found themselves there, and liking it, and getting more involved later. So, and actually, interestingly, like, when I talked to the young people who were involved in this kind of work, nobody really brought that up as a problem that they were facing. But I don't know why. Maybe because I was a white researcher, maybe because I was interviewing them at their, where they were doing the work, as opposed to, say, in a corner in their regular classroom.
You wonder, depending on communities and, histories and values there, coming from Latino communities, being political is sort of a taboo, but also there's a rich history of it, so there's tension there, but it's interesting to hear reflections on that and strategies.
And I don't know if it also made a difference that, say, when I've worked with partner organizations and done research there and so forth, if almost always they tend to be led by indigenous members of the community. So they try to be very, I don't know what, your organization, who your organization was led by, but, I I'm not sure about this, but I don't think Hyde Square Task Force would hire a, you know, young, white, enthusiastic, middle-class woman to, you know, come in and lead the show. And, like, when I was doing research in Dearborn, in their Arab-American sort of organization, it was, you know, young Arab-American woman wearing a headscarf who was the leader of the youth group and who had attended high schools there. And so I'm not sure how much it matters if you can see the adult facilitators and leadership is also coming from the community.
It's probably situational.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, go ahead.
Do you think that...
Could you introduce yourself, please?
I'm Demet Arpacik from Turkey, Kurdistan, and I'm from Education Department in Educational Leadership. I'm a master student. So I was thinking, in addition to education, do you think media also has an importance in this underrepresentation? Because even from an international perspective, when we look at U.S., since it's bringing democracy to all around the world, we think that, you know, like, as if they have the best democracy. And I was thinking that the conditions will be different here, which is not the case. Even they, I think, deceive their citizens in terms of this, trying to create such a discourse that it is the most democratic state in the world. What do you think about that?
Yeah, so I think that the sort of self and other presentation is disempowering in a variety of ways. So one is that we don't spend much time, if any time, as a nation talking about, say, the civic empowerment gap. You know, in some ways, if the civic empowerment gap became a buzzword in the same way as the academic achievement gap, that would be fabulous from my perspective, because it would take, again, knowledge that basically any political science academic has, and many just educated people, and turn it from sort of this implicit knowledge or tacit knowledge or sort of naturalized knowledge of, well, this is what we do, but it's not something we have to work on, to a policy relevant, oh my gosh, this is a real problem that we need to tackle. And you are right, we do not discuss in this country much that this is a real problem we need to tackle. And if anything, actually, the discourse after the 2012 presidential election, where Latinos now have started to play a role and are being seen as being potentially significant players in the Republican Party, is thinking about how to sort of shift in order to tap into these, you know, new and different, more diverse populations. It's, if anything, it could suggest that this problem sort of never existed and certainly doesn't exist now, whereas it still does. The fact that we have Latinos may now start getting more attention is great, but it doesn't get rid of the entire problem. But there are many other issues too. So one of the things that, say, Americans are very aware of about their democracy is that it's incredibly polarized in terms of political, right now, sort of public political institutions at the federal level, like Congress, right? Congress is a disaster. It is dysfunctional, it is ineffective, it models some of the worst aspects of, you know, public discourse right now, if it can even be described as discourse. And it dominates people's conceptions of what politics is and means. So when you think about politics or political engagement, I think people say, think about Congress, and think, that's horrible, right? I certainly wouldn't want to get involved in that, and you can't make a difference anyway, as opposed to thinking about their local city council, their board of aldermen, their school board, zoning councils, all sorts of political and civic organizations that don't look like Congress at all. And so if we could also sort of reorient our media and our coverage to think, to elevate and focus on all of the ways in which there are potentials to get involved in civic and political engagement and discourse that's actually a lot more pleasant and functional than Congress is right now, that might also provide people more of a route in. But that's a very nationally focused answer rather than an internationally focused answer.
Well, you know, as I'm sure you know, there's a lot of data that says that even highly engaged people are fantastically ignorant about basic political facts, like the one that's always cited is how many people think that foreign aid constitutes 25% of the
vote. Right. Uh-huh.
And so given that among the already engaged, would there be any chance that you could do more than just fill the gap, but in a sense jump over? That if you got new people, you could jump over that and actually raise the level of knowledge of everyone in a sense.
That seems great to me. I mean, I think it seems possible. One of the things that, so a few years ago when I was using the language rather than the civic empowerment gap, the civic achievement gap, and actually it was my doctoral, some graduate students at the that the Harvard Graduate School of Education where I just started teaching, who kept saying to me, Mira, that's the wrong language. Are you really trying to like normalize white middle-class kids in Sudbury and say that their level of civic and political knowledge and engagement is what we want? Like, we want a whole bunch of sort of apathetic, self-satisfied kids who pat themselves on the back for doing some service and you know, then, like, go on. I said, no, that's not my point. And so finally I realized, all right, that's really not my point. It's not, right, nobody's very good in this country on this. But there are these differences, these real differences in power. So that's why I now call it the civic empowerment gap. But yes, if as we shifted the civic empowerment gap, we not only came up with better policies, but also just more knowledgeable people, because the knowledge came from a broader base and was about different things, and also forced others to step up their game, that would be a really good thing.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Regan. I'm the interim coordinator for student conduct here at BC. And last fall, these are my two colleagues, we are on a group that started the Civic Engagement Initiative here at BC. And, you know, a lot of your teachers, it seems like, has been in the elementary, secondary school. And when you're looking at colleges and universities and trying to fill that gap within this population, what we have found is that the understanding of civic engagement at so many institutions is purely volunteerism.
Mm-hmm.
And that idea of civic literacy and that true idea of civic engagement and being involved in the government and understanding of those concepts just aren't there.
Mm-hmm.
Have you had any experience or understanding of other institutions that are doing this well, or examples that you have come across?
That's a really good question. So so in a way, I am very parochial because I spent about a decade in urban middle schools. That's what I was sort of most interested in, and you know, wrote, and in a way, writing No Citizen Left Behind stemmed entirely from, these are questions I'm struggling with as a teacher myself. What should I be doing with my kids? Why and how? And, you know, then sort of generalizing to sort of other urban schools and urban communities. And I was thoroughly uninterested in higher education, even when I then switched to teaching at the higher ed level, at the graduate level. And it's only recently that I've finally started acknowledging that there might be something sort of educationally interesting about higher ed, and that it's not merely a nice pampered place for, you know, those of us lucky enough to indulge in spending time here, but not like where the real work gets done. So that's all a sort of background to say I haven't done much looking at it. I have to say I admire what Tisch College has done, you know, at Tufts. I think they really have been quite intentional about changing the idea of what civic engagement means, and about working with faculty across a humongous variety of disciplines and departments and so forth, right, for how it can be incorporated. But my short answer is you guys probably know a lot more about, you know, the landscape in higher ed than I do. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, all right, thank you.
I had a quick question. I wonder if you might speak to the public and non-public school differences on this very question.
Mm-hmm.
It's been said, people like Walter Feinberg and others have looked at Catholic schools, mm-hmm. and the civic outcomes and their orientation toward the common good that's higher, by a lot of studies at least, than
yeah.
public schools. Is there something, do you share that opinion, first of all, that view of the data? And second of all, is there something to be learned by those organizations or non-public schools that might be translated into public schools.
So I haven't done any independent looking at the data. I've just read, you know, Wally's and other work on this, and it seems pretty right to me. I mean, I don't read it and think, what? You know, so I think it's probably correct. Dave Campbell, actually, and who's a professor of political science at Notre Dame, has a chapter in Making Civics Count, this edited volume that we worked on together, that looks at private and charter schools as compared to regular district public schools, saying, okay, so we know, you know, the data do continue to show that both private schools and actually many charter schools seem to have sort of more reliably or on average sort of more empowering school cultures and perhaps better civic outcomes than regular district public schools. But he argues we don't know why, right? We can come up with educated guesses as to why, but we really don't know, and so that's where we should actually start doing work as opposed to sort of hurling accusations about what's better or what's worse. One of the, as a sort of a sidestepping answer to this question, I've been thinking recently, so I'm working on this new project on justice in schools, and I've been thinking about the case of these no-excuses charter schools, like KIPP and Common Schools and others, that seem to have very high graduation rates and college attendance rates, so long as you ignore the very, very high percentage of kids who have been pushed out before senior year. So often that sort of amounts to about 50%. And so there's this question, and so then people will say accusingly, well, regular district schools can't push out 50% of their kids, right? So, you know, you guys are disasters here. And it's possible that the right answer, Mike Petrilli has written a little bit about this, right? The right answer is to say, well, but KIPP can't do its work. It does its work in a certain way with a certain school culture, whatever you think of that culture, and, you know, having certain demands. And it's better, in fact, to serve the 50% of the kids that they keep really, really well by certain measures, and say including college attendance measures, even if that means losing the other 50%, then sort of serving all much more mediocrely. I mean, I think there's a whole bunch of ethical considerations and practical considerations and questions about KIPP's culture and so forth. But it relates to your question, because part of this is a question about, well, what is transferable and what is not? You know, how much of it is about selecting in and pushing out, and how much of it is about certain kinds of school practices that if regular district public schools were given the breathing space to try to create and the encouragement and so forth, were rewarded for that as opposed to simply for standardized test scores, then maybe they could also construct similarly empowering spaces.
Yes.
If we have time, I'm Claire Johnson. I'm a doc student in educational research measurement and evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned accountability measures, and I was wondering if you could talk about that a little bit, because I think we know that in addressing the academic achievement gap, the accountability measures haven't really functioned the way people hoped that
right.
they would necessarily. And so I was wondering what you envision an ideal accountability system for the civic empowerment gap to look like.
Yeah, so it was this question that really stymied me and for years. I mean, it literally delayed this book coming out for about 2.5 years beyond what otherwise it would have taken, because I was just stuck on this question. And, you know, the easy thing is to say, no accountability measures, right? It's a disaster. It's been proved that these things are horrible for, you know. But I do view standards and assessment and accountability as having a democratic function and role, that it is schools are where we are trying to create our future selves, and that we as a democratic public have a role to play in articulating that and expecting certain things from that and demanding it. In the end, what I decided is, you know, input assessments and accountability isn't that bad. It's imperfect. But what if every middle school and high school in this country had a functioning school newspaper, had a school government that was demonstrably inclusive along a variety of dimensions, and that had a budget, and where you could say, look at selected minutes or initiatives or something that showed that they were doing something governance related as opposed to just planning the school dances? What if every district, every school in the country had some kind of civic curriculum that happened and was able to demonstrate 4 points in kids' lives in middle school and high school where they went out of the building to take some form of civic action, whether that was merely service or whether it was more policy-oriented or internship-oriented or public speaking-oriented or something. I think there are a set of accountability measures and assessments like that that totally could be gamed, right? There are all sorts of problems with, input assessments as there are with output assessments. But I think it wouldn't be a bad thing to sort of set as an expectation and as a start. And then we would just have to work carefully as time went on to make them less gameable and more authentic. The one other thing I'll say about accountability is that with the shift to digital media, there's been a lot of interest recently in badging. And so where kids or adults, whoever, develop skills, they acquire skills and knowledge through whatever context they want to, and then they demonstrate those skills and knowledge in an authentic way, and they can do that often through simulations actually online, or through authentic experiences online, but where you can have, via digital assessment, in fact, you have kids or adults demonstrating, wow, you really can make an argument, you really can take a position on a contentious issue and pull in correct, evidence to support it and confront those who disagree with you. Or you really have, corresponded with these diverse people or, done whatever. And so that, I think, is the other really interesting direction to go with assessment and accountability is badging, in which you can have really authentic simulations where kids go through a whole process of demonstrating high-level skills and knowledge.
We have time for one more question, I think. Yeah.
Hi, Lauren Sines. I'm an assistant professor in the Lynch School here. I think you touched on this sort of in a couple different ways, and I think it's really interesting the idea that there's also this gap between, that youth civic engagement and adult receptiveness to that engagement, and a lot to do with power. But, I'm wondering, in terms of, so there's a lot of education to be done on the adult side of it too, and I'm just wondering, we talk in teacher education a lot about social justice and teaching teachers to teach for social justice. There's not a whole lot of conversation about civic engagement, and I'm wondering what you see the role of teacher education as in that process.
Yeah, I think it has to be pretty huge. Actually, in this book, Making Civics Count, we have two really good chapters. Keith Barton writes one about pre-service teacher education, and then Diana Hess has one about in-service teacher education with regard to civic education and empowerment. We have a much greater role to play, I think, in teaching teachers how to, do civic education well. It is also the case that we right now treat many teachers very disrespectfully, and they feel very disempowered and so forth. And it's really hard, even if you know how to do civic education well and care about it, to be able to transmit a sense of empowerment and engagement and so forth when you yourself feel disempowered. And certainly if you don't have an opening into that, right, if you haven't thought one way or another about civic engagement, and you are part of an institution that sort of feels as if it devalues you and doesn't care about your voice, and, you merely have to follow the pacing guide, et cetera, conversations then about civic empowerment can feel very distant and irrelevant indeed. So part of this is also, when we change the culture of the school for kids, which I think we need to make them more respectful and inclusive and empowering places, we also need to change the culture for teachers to make them more respectful and inclusive and empowering places.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Professor Levinson, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.